Okay, we are on the air. All right, so some shilas that were sent in. One of them was sent in by, who's not here yet? Okay, Alex, we'll see when he gets back here. Olives, having olives, eating olives. Are you allowed to eat olives? The Gemara in Hari says that if you eat olives, you will forget what you learned. And no one wants to do that, especially if we haven't learned so much. Imagine forgetting what the little bit that we know. It'd be terrible. But the Chareinim say that because it is, because we pickle them, it's not the olive that the Gemara is referring to. And therefore, we can be lenient, so to speak, and have olives, and hopefully will have no effect on us. And so definitely there are poskim that say it's a problem, but the minhag is to eat them. And the reason is that our pickled olives, which are the only types that we really eat, are not what the Gemara is referring to, so it's okay. The olive oil is wonderful. That Gemara says returns your memory. So definitely drink a few cups of olive oil every day. Now, as far as another shayla sent in was, what about is a phone muksa on Shabbos? It'll come up a few scenarios. First of all, let's say you want that to be your alarm and you need to move it with you. You need to put it in the right place, or it's ringing and you want to move it to a different place because it's loud and people are still sleeping. So we paskin that a phone is considered a kli shemalachto l'isser, which means it is a vessel, it has a use, but its designated use is isser, which means you can move it if you need its placement or if you need the actual thing, like to hold a door open. So for our purposes, you don't not gonna use a phone to hold a door open, but you would want to use a phone to be your alarm, or if it's in, you left it on your bed and you want to move it. So we pass that a phone is considered a kli, and therefore you can move it if you need its placement. And therefore also, if you want to position the phone in a certain area for the alarm, it would be fine. And you have to be careful though, that you don't push buttons and that you don't have a moving sensor that every time you move it, it's going to go on. And it's going to tempt you to send a text to make a call. Well, then don't do it. But just as far as the world of muksa goes, it would be okay to move it. But you have to know yourself that you're not going to come to push any buttons, check the score, or anything else like that. And the last I will discuss is inviting over a guest for Shabbos that would drive home. A Machal Shabbos, and he lives 7 miles away from your house, and it's 30 degrees outside and snowing, and he's not going to be walking home. If the phone is plugged into the charger, you can't unplug the charger. You can't unplug the phone from the wall, but the phone itself could be moved a little bit. But the point is, you still can't unplug it or anything. Okay, so back to our guest. So the
Machal. Even if it's 100% charged and the phone has an automatic block of the charging?
Okay, that's above my pay grade. What Zevi's asking is, if it's plugged into the wall and it's 100% charged, so it's not getting anything, can you unplug it? I don't know. You would have to check to make sure there's no electrical connection. It's not a two-way street. There's zero electricity going from one to the other. I don't know about that. You could ask someone who does know. Here we go. On that note,
if you have a time clock in a wall that a light is going to go off in 2 hours, can you push or remove pins to make the light go off earlier or later?
Right. So if it's so that is a sugya by itself. The short answer is, if it's mechanical, not electric, I mean, all it is are the pins. There's no, you're not changing numbers, whatever, electrically, just mechanically. So there is a machlokas. Rav Moshe Feinstein was not a big fan of it. He didn't like it very much. But Shlomo Zalman was more lenient. The general rule is, if you need it, you can rely on the heter, but only to extend status quo. Which means if it's on, you can make it stay on longer. And if it's off, you can make it stay off longer, but not to shorten the current position. Okay, that's the short of it, but definitely try to avoid it if you could. The last question was, the Machal Shabbos that you want to invite for Shabbos meal, and you know he's going to drive home. So by you inviting him, really what you're doing is, here, please come to my house and drive home on Shabbos afterwards. You're not verbalizing that, but that's really what's happening. And it should not be done. What is recommended is, you invite him to come for Shabbos. And listen, I know you live far away, and I know we don't drive on Shabbos. You're invited to sleep over my house. You don't need to tell me. I'm going to have a bed ready for you to sleep over. You don't need to ask him what he's doing. you can invite him for him to sleep over and have real accommodations for him. And then whatever he ends up doing is his business and not your business. But you provide for him the opportunity to come and knock him call shots. Okay, here we go. But if he does come, you cannot steal his keys. That is something a little bit, probably not a good idea in Kiruv. And also you can't really steal someone's keys. Okay, tonight's regular scheduled program. Here, we're going to try to do Bishul Akum and Hafrashas Challah tonight. Bishul Akum and Hafrashas Challah. So we'll start with Bishul Akum. So the reason if a guy cooks food for you, which we'll discuss, very relevant if you have a housekeeper, a nanny, a live-in, or if you have someone helping and assisting a sick patient, sick person, an elderly somebody, an elderly great-great-great-grandfather. So are you allowed to eat the food that that guy cooks? The general rule is no, you cannot. It's not usher to benefit from it. So you could feed it to your dogs, but it does, there is an issue to eat it. And the reason is we want to make more separations between Jews and Goyim. We do not want you to be having nice meals and social gatherings with them, which would lead to perhaps intermarriage. And therefore, in every scenario, whether even if the guy is 97 years old and you're not going to marry her and she has no kids, still we do not allow you to eat from the food that she cooked. This is the same halacha, whether it's cooked, fried, baked, roasted, microwaved, any of these, any way you would cook the food would be aser. If it was fully cooked and all that the guy is doing is rewarming it, heating it up, that's fine. So the guy can stick the food in the microwave if it's fully cooked. But vice versa would not be fine. Meaning if the guy cooked it, it doesn't help now that you go ahead and warm it up. Once it's fully cooked, it doesn't help to Jew warm it up. But if it's fully cooked, the guy, and if the Jew cooked it, and now it's cold, the guy could warm it up for you. Okay, those are the general rules we discussed. We're going to get to that very soon. We discussed by the bread sugya. When Goyim cook bread, it's also a problem. But there we discussed the heter that if it's a baker's bread, it's not a personal connection, then it's okay. That heter does not exist by cooking. So if you have an institution, a factory, a larger organization that cooks things, it's still not allowed. So again, even though all the food is kosher, you know it's kosher. Let's just say you stood over his shoulder and watched him the whole time. You still cannot eat the food that a guy cooked. Now, there are two exceptions to that rule. One of them is food which is not chashuv. The issur is only relevant and only applies when the food is, what the Shulchan Aruch says, roi for shulchan melachim, that you would put on a king's table. So if he's making pasta, if he's making coffee, tea, those, even though you may put that on a king's table, those are not considered chashuv foods. And therefore, if you go to Dunkin' Donuts or other areas that a guy is cooking the food, cooks, right, making you a coffee, a tea, that would be okay because that's not considered a chashuv food. However, if it's chicken, if it's meat, if it's potatoes, now if it's on the king's table, it'll be garnished and have a fancy special name. But at the end of the day, chicken, meat's meat. These are things which are considered chashuv. So even if it doesn't look so good, it may not even taste so good, it's still in the category of chashuv food. And therefore, it could not be eaten. Eggs, also, the Shulchan Aruch brings down, you cannot have an egg that was made by a guy. Even though that we don't think it's so chashuv, still that applies today as well. Okay, so just how to apply this heter is very difficult. But in general, you have to look at, is it a chashuv food? Then it's a problem. If it's not a chashuv food, then it's fine. Another heter is a food which is edible without cooking and which you would normally eat without cooking. For example, carrots, apples. These things, the cooking process doesn't give a tremendous benefit, doesn't improve it so much. And therefore, you would be allowed to eat if the guy cooked it. So I have a carrot and the guy went ahead and cooked my carrot. I could eat that carrot because the changing there is not significant. So that's another heter. Those are two heterim. Now, here is the major shaila and the main discussion, which we need to put on the table, is what constitutes cooking and how can a Jew help the situation and what do the restaurants do that's full of goyim cooking? So the heter, which is out there, which is brought down, is that the Jew turns the fire on. So let's understand what that means. So we have some Svaradim here tonight, and we have a major machlokes, Ashkenazi Svaradi. The Svaradim are super duper machmir with this, and the Ashkenazim are super duper makel with this. So we want to try to lay it out clearly. According to the Ashkenazic ruling, as long as the Jew turned the fire on, or the Jew like stoked the coals, did something to improve the heat, that's enough that from now on that fire is considered cooked by a Jew. Even though the guy actually put it on the fire, the fact that the Jew turned the fire on is sufficient. The Svaradim do not agree with that, and they say that's not good enough. You require the Jew to actually put the fire on. They'll put the food on the fire. And if they do not put the food on the fire that is cooked, considered cooked by a guy, and a problem. So many yeshivas, many restaurants rely on a heter here. And if you're a Svaradi, you have to make sure that the heter is a good heter, and that the Jew is really involved in the kitchen. Or the Ashkenazim can be more lenient. Another major machlokas here is, what point is it considered cooked, and what point is it, and therefore ruined? At what point is it considered not cooked yet, and therefore you can still save the food? Meaning like this. Let's say the guy puts on the fire, and it's on the fire for 27 seconds, and then you say, oh my gosh, is it too late? It was already on there for 27 seconds. Or it was on there for 4 hours. Is there a way to fix it? So here again, we have a machlokes Ashkenazi Svaradim. And here's the way this goes. Everyone agrees, Ashkenazi Svaradi, if the food is fully cooked to a point where you would ideally serve it, it's perfect. Now, you may cook it more just for added flavor, but it's fully cooked. You would have no problem serving this food. At that point, if the guy brought it to that point, the food is out there. There's no way to fix it. You can't say, oh, I'm going to take it off and put it back on. It's already done. That food is fully cooked, and therefore it is not edible. If, however, it got, let's say it's still raw, less than a third cooked, then everyone agrees you can fix it. So if the food normally takes 2 hours to cook, and it was on the fire for 1/3 of 2 hours, which would probably be around 40 minutes, so then that would be okay for the Jew to go ahead and take it off and put it back on if you're Svaradi. If you're Ashkenazi, turn the fire off, turn it back on. Because you caught it in time. You caught it before it reached a real level of cookage. And therefore, it would be fine. That would be the way to fix it. The machlokas Ashkenazi Svaradi is between 1/3 and fully cooked. So let's say you came in to, it's halfway cooked. It's only been on the fire for 1 hour. It's edible if you be a thief. It's something, you know, that is potentially you would eat it. The Ashkenazim hold, you can still fix the situation. It's not considered halakhically cooked for this. And therefore, if you're Ashkenazi, you just turn the fire off, turn the fire on. However, Svaradim hold, once it's reached more than a third, that's halakhically cooked, and that food is ruined. The Svaradim have one heter, which is, if it is Erev Shabbos, and you need the food for Shabbos, so then you could be lenient and eat that food. Hello, Dr. Langer. What we're discussing right now is, if a guy cooked the food and you're Ashkenazi and it's not fully cooked, take it off the fire, put it back on, turn the fire off, turn it back on, and you can still make the food kosher. If, however, again, we're not talking, the ingredients are kosher, it's just he cooked it. You're not allowed to have the guy cook it. If, however, you're Svaradi and it was after 1/3 cooked, so then in normal situations, you cannot eat that food. If, however, you need that food for Shabbos, you have no other food, so then it would be fine to rely on that heter. Now, let's say the guy brought it up to a third cooked. Sorry, let's say the Jew. The Jew brought it up to a third cooked, and then a guy took it off and put it back on. Can you ruin the food? Once the Jew has brought it up to a third cooked, everyone agrees that it's okay. Okay, so those are three scenarios. We have the guy brought it up to a third, machlokes Ashkenazi Svaradi. The Jew brought it up to a third, that's fine, even if a guy gets involved now. But if it's fully cooked, everyone agrees it's a problem. what's considered bishul. If you are Svardi, you have to actually put it on. And if you're Ashkenazi, it's enough to turn it on and off. Now, a major question is let's say there's a power outage. Okay, so you have your oven cooking your chicken. You put it in. It's in there 20 minutes, 25 minutes. Power outage. 10 seconds later, the lights come back on. The electricity comes back on. Who just turned on your oven? It wasn't you. It was Muhammad, who runs the electric company. He just went ahead and turned your oven on. So you can thank him for cooking your food, because that's what he just did. The oven was off. He flipped the switch. You now have cooked food thanks to Muhammad. Is that okay?
But isn't it only on because of you?
It was not. It was off. I went to sleep.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have turned on if you didn't enable the oven.
You're right.
The oven doesn't just go on when you turn on the electric.
But listen, you had it on already, and then it got shut off. And now he turns it back on. At this moment, the reason why he's cooking at this moment, yeah, you started the ball, but then your ball ended. It stopped. Now you go ahead and turn it back on. Sorry, the guy turns it back on. He turns it back on. So I'll tell you, the heter, it is mutter, and I'll explain why. Because in order for it to be usher, it has to be that the guy turned it on with intent to cook. Only if the guy turns it on with intent to cook, which is in most scenarios. Normally, when you put it on the stove, on the oven, he did it with intent to cook. If, however, my scenario, he did not do it with intent to cook. He did it with intent to keep his job, intent to put electricity in the city, and therefore it will be fine. Now, as far as a elderly mother, father, grandfather, grandmother who has someone, an aide, who is staying with them, cooking for them. So again, ideally, if you would want the food to be cooked by the Jew, even in that scenario. But the Eved, though, there is no one else to cook this person food, and the only one is a guy, so b'di'eved, you can rely on that and it would be okay. But again, ideally you wouldn't want to have to get there. Hello, Jay. You wouldn't want to get there and therefore try to find another way of doing it. But if not, then it is okay. The last thing is, what happens to the pots? What happens to the pots if a guy did cook? So you have a cleaning lady, a nanny, a housekeeper, and live-in, or whatever else you want to call them, and they cook your food. You cannot eat that food. Those pots that were cooked in now need to be kashered. They cooked, even though every ingredient there was kosher, and you stood over her shoulder and you watched her every second. But because you didn't put it on the fire, you didn't turn the fire on, that's called bishul akum, and therefore the pots need to be kashered. One more thing, which is very important, is you're not allowed to leave a guy home with all the pots if she feels comfortable that you're not coming back so quick, and therefore she feels like she could go ahead and cook. Meaning, you have a housekeeper, and you say, "Bye, I'm going out. I'll be back in 8 hours. I have to go to work today. I'm back in 8 hours." She feels very comfortable now that she can cook, do whatever she wants, even though she'll use all the kosher ingredients. But since she feels comfortable, that could be a real problem with the kelim, even though you don't know she did anything. And even if she denies she did anything. It's called yichud, being alone with kelim. We don't think she's going to do anything immoral with your kelim, but we do, and we are concerned that she may cook with your kelim. And therefore, whenever you need to go out, do not give her that feeling. Just say, "I'm going out, I'll be back. I'm going out, I'll be back." Don't tell her how long and where. If you did it, it's a shaila, it should be asked. There are some leniencies after the fact, but definitely, ideally, you would not want to leave her alone with your kelim, that she'll feel comfortable. Okay, that's the end of Bishul Akam. Hello, Yechazko. Malo tov to Yechazko, Astreichai. Benu Chasim. We will, Mitzvah, now do Hafresh Eschala. Okay, Hafresh Eschala, let me explain what that is. So you have dough, and there is a mitzvah to separate from the dough and give it to a kohen. If you live in Eretz Yisrael, it's a mitzvah de Araisa. No one here does. And therefore, if you live in Chutz La'aretz, like everyone here does, it is a mitzvah de Rabbanan to take off challah from the dough. We call it challah. We're not referring to what we eat Friday night. It's the halachic challah, which is similar to truma, a donation to a kohen. You take it off, not just from your fruits and your vegetables, but also from your dough. That's challah in Eretz Yisrael de Araisa, and Chutz La'aretz de Rabbanan, and you give it to a kohen. Today, we are Tameh, the Kohen is Tameh, the Challah is Tameh, so we can't do any of that. So what we do today is we burn it. And now that's the general look at what Challah is. And the Sephorno says, by doing Challah, Hafrashas Challah in your house, you'll bring Bracha to your house. And therefore, there's a lot of segulas involving Challah. It's definitely a good idea if you're going to bake Challah, but you don't have to go ahead and bake Challah just to do this. But if you are going to bake, you make sure you need to do Hafrashas Challah, as we will get to explain right now. Okay, now there's no difference whether you are making Challahs, bread, or cookies or cakes. If you have the right amount, which we'll see soon, there is a chiyah to do Hafrashas Challah from the dough of bread, from the dough of cakes, from the dough of cookies. Okay, so that is a chiyah of Hafrashas Challah from all types of doughs. What is the minimum amount of flour? So here's the way this goes. If it is 2.5 pounds of flour or less that's being used in this batter, you do not need to do any Hafrashas Challah. And most cakes and cookies are like that. But again, if it is 2.5 pounds of flour or less, you do not need to do Hafrashas Challah. If it is between 2.5 and 5 pounds of flour in this dough, then you need to do Hafrashas Challah without a bracha. So you definitely take off the challah, but no bracha. If it is 5 pounds of flour or more, so then you take off challah with a bracha. Okay, so it's 0 to 2.5, 2.5 to 5, 2.5 to 5, and 5 and up. Those are the measurements of what will obligate or not obligate you in Hafrashas Challah. Now, the ideal time to take the challah off is while it's still dough. You put it all together, a big pile of dough, and then you take it off, you make the bracha first, because all mitzvahs we do, Oyver Las Yasan, before you do the mitzvah, so you bring, Bracha Tashem, Al-Kinu Machalam, Ashek, Yishanu, B'mitzvah, Yisavis, Yivanu, Lahafish Challah, and some add, Min Ha'isa, to take off challah from the dough. So some do that minhag, that is my wife's minhag, Lahafish Challah, Min Ha'isa, and then you pull it off, and whatever comes off, you don't put anything back. Now you want to make sure you pull out at least a kazayas worth. A kazayas is a matchbox or more. You can be generous. Well, you don't have to be generous, but at least a kazayas. So you pull it off. Whatever comes off, you should have in mind that whatever you're pulling off, that will be the challah. And then you wrap it up and we'll get to what you do with it soon. Okay, so that is the actual maisa of a fresh challah. If you forgot and you cooked the food, you cooked the bread, you made the cookies without doing a fresh challah, no problem. After it's baked, you can now do it. So put all the stuff together again. Bring all the cooked breads and cakes and cookies together. Put them all on the same table. And then take off a fresh challah from the cooked bread. You'll take off a kazayas from the cookies of bread. So it's not too late. Until it's eaten, it's not too late to rectify any mistake that was made. Okay? So you have your dough here. If, let's say, you plan on freezing the dough, I mean, you're going to go ahead and make small rolls and freeze the dough, so then take off challah now. Before you make them into small loaves of bread, do Hafrashas Challah, and then go ahead and freeze them. If, however, you are going to give the rolls of dough to other people to bake, right? They're having a massive challah bake. So you go ahead and make the big dough, and you give out to everyone a pile of dough, and they're going to make their own challahs. In that case, there's no Hafrashas Challah. If you are giving out dough to other people and you will be left with less than 5 pounds or 2.5 pounds, like we said, then there's no Hafrashas Challah. If, however, you are going to bake the challahs and then give out challah rolls, then you do Hafrashas Challah. Okay, so here's the way it goes. 3 parts. If you are freezing dough for you, take off challah now. If you're giving out dough to other people, no Hafrashas Challah, unless you will be left with the appropriate amount. If you are giving out rolls, cooked stuff, so then you do Hafrashas Challah while it's still dough, and then you give it out. If you forgot and you baked already, then you need to take off challah now after it's cooked. Now this may happen. Let's say you forgot to take off challah and you gave someone a roll. You gave someone some bread. So right now what's happening is you have given them bread, which challah has not been taken off. What you really should do is give them a little call and say, hi, either take a little bit off without a bracha because it's not there anymore, just take a little bit off, or you can take off better if they bring it back and you to take it off. If that's super duper embarrassing, you don't really want to call them off. You just want to take it off yourself. I need to double check if you can do that because it's not here anymore. So maybe my HaFarshas Challah here will not work. I have a hunch that in Eretz Yisrael, it's no good. And in America, it is good. But I want to double check that. But definitely don't come to that situation and make sure you take off Challah in the appropriate time. Now, what happens if Friday night, you sit down and you realize you forgot to take off the Challah. You forgot to do HaFarshas Challah. What happens now? So if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you knock on your neighbor's door and you borrow a challah from them because there's no way to fix it. If, however, in Chutz La'aretz, because only the Rabbanan, there's a heter, you could eat it now and just make sure you leave over a sufficient amount that Matzi Shabbos, you will take off part of that kazayis worth. So on Shabbos, you cannot do a HaFarshas Challah, but Matzi Shabbos, you'll take it off. You have to leave over more than a kazayis because you take off a kazayis and then the remnants will be mutter. Okay, so do not forget, but if you forget, that's what happened. Now, what do you do with the HaFarshas Challah? This challah you took off, what do you do now? So ideally what you want to do is burn it. In my house, what we do is we save it the whole year and we burn it with the chametz. If you're going to do that, you just have to make sure you don't lose them and that you don't mix them up with other things and that you don't eat them. But you want to burn them. If you do not want to wait until Pesach, so then what you can do is to flatten it and then wrap it up in tin foil and stick it in your oven on the highest and it'll burn inside the oven. However, you want to make sure it's fully covered because if it's not fully covered, you may chafe up parts of your oven if it touches the racks, if it touches other food, because the challah itself is also to eat. And therefore, if you're going to burn in your oven, wrap it up well, fully covered. You don't need double covering, just one cover, but make sure it's fully covered. And then you can burn it in your oven until it turns brown. At that point, you will now go ahead and then throw it in the garbage. Better to throw in the garbage when it's wrapped because we did a mitzvah with it. So you would want to throw it out wrapped. Okay, that is a wrap on Hilchas HaFarshas Challah. Next week, we'll do bathroom related halachas, like singing nice music in the bathroom, listening to music, talking in the bathroom, thinking about learning in the bathroom, washing your hands, other related bathroom shilas. If you have any shilas in the bathroom, please send them in. We will now move on to bitachon.
How big of a piece of dough do you have to take off?
If what? How big
of a piece?
It has to be a kazayis worth. You have freshest kazayis, be kazayis worth. And a kazayis is around a matchbox, a small matchbox. You take a little bit more, but that is the shear. Okay, so Hilchas Bitachon, We are in Bitachon in Shar Gimel of the Chovos HaLevavos. So we discussed last week, the reason why we have to do a shtablis for Parnassa is to make sure that we're going to follow Hashem's will. It's like a test. Will you earn your Parnassa in a mutter way? Will you do it appropriately? Will you do averas in earning money? So it's like a test of how you're gonna earn the money. Also to keep you busy. So you shouldn't come to do averas. So Hashem gives us work to go ahead and do averas. So the Chovos HaLevavos says, so what happens if you have a big tzaddik and he's learning all day? So he says, that person is proving to Hashem, I always do your mitzvahs, I always learn your Torah. You don't need to test me. And therefore he doesn't necessarily have to do hishtadlis. And when I'm free, I never waste my time. And therefore, you don't need to give me busy work to keep me busy not to do averes. I'm not going to do it anyway. And that's the idea that he brings down. That's why you do see some people, I know some of them, that don't really have a job and still they have parnassa. The idea is that they are hopefully not wasting their time and they're busy doing good things. And therefore, there's no added need for them to work. Now, he goes on to a major, difficult, hashkafic Shaila, which is, how is it possible that you have many tzaddikim that don't have food, and you have many rishayim that have everything in the world, otherwise known as tzaddik viralo, rasha v'toivle, a tzaddik that's having hard times and a rasha who's having great times. How could that be? So that's the question he discusses here. And he says, he ends off with, there's a pasuk in Devarim, pasuk perachav tes, hanistarais l'Hashem Elokeinu. Things that are hidden, only Hashem will understand them. What's revealed, we will understand. but certain things that are hidden, we don't understand. And he explains that Hashem judges each person on a very, very individual level and knows exactly what he should be tested on, how he should be tested, if he should be tested. And therefore, perhaps what you're seeing, that guy who has all the money, or that Machala Shabbos who's raking it in, yeah, maybe you're jealous, but really, maybe he deserves it. Maybe Hashem is rewarding him for something. Maybe it's just a bigger test. Maybe he's going to get it all now in this world and not in the next world. Therefore, and you look at that righteous person who does all the Torah mitzvahs properly and he's suffering, there's a reason for it. It's a test. It's giving him one last punishment for whatever he's done wrong. Again, we don't know the ways of Hashem, but that's the flow over here. We have to do our shtalis, then Hashem gives it to us. And if you're doing good stuff with your time, maybe Hashem will require you to do less shtalis. But no matter what's happening, no matter how good or bad you are, or you think you are, you cannot necessarily judge yourself or your friends based on their success, because that may be coming for a different reason. We don't know. A thought in davening, we're up to in Shmoneh Esrei Rifa'enu. So Rifa'enu, we're davening that Hashem should heal us, bring a refuah. What we should have in mind is, it's not just that we want to be healthy because we want to be able to do what we want to do. We want to be able to go skiing and go to the game and do whatever we want, or we just don't want to be in pain. What you should be davening for is, I want to be healthy so that I can do your will, so that I can daven better, so that I could learn better, so that I could do more mitzvahs with other people. The davening should be focused, not just, I want to be well, but I want to be well for a certain reason. And whether it is physical health or mental health, it all can be put into this tefillah. You want to daven for your health so that you can do good things with it. That's the idea in Rifa'inu. The Rambam says, we daven not to have wars. The Rambam says, what do I care if there's a war? So what? So I'll die, then I'll go to Olam Haba. What's the problem if there's a war? What's the problem if I die? So he says, the whole idea is, we want to be able to do Hashem's will in this world. We want to be able to do Torah mitzvahs. If there's a war, we're not going to be able to do Torah mitzvahs. That's the problem of a war. It's not there's a problem by itself. Oh, there's a war, it's scary. It's that I won't be able to do Torah mitzvahs. Same thing with sickness. Whenever there's sickness, you will be inhibited from doing Hashem's will in other areas. So therefore, Rifa'inu is the time to daven Hashem, please let me be physically healthy, please let me be mentally healthy, so that I will be able to do Torah mitzvahs. Okay, that is a tefillah thought. Now, this week's parsha, Parshas Yisrael. So Yisrael was Vayishma Yisrael. Yisrael heard. Rashi explains he heard about Amalek, he heard about Kriyas Yamsuf. And Rashi says the words, Shama Uba. He heard and he came. And this is a big idea that we a lot of time hear inspirational stories, we'll watch an inspirational video. And what do you do right after you watch an inspirational video? You watch another one, or you'll talk about it, right? You like that one, Josh? But you don't necessarily go ahead and act upon it. The idea behind an inspirational story or an inspirational event is do something now. Shama Uba. Yisro heard it and did something. He was inspired and he acted upon it. He didn't just say, wow, that's so amazing, and then move on the rest of his life. And therefore, every time you hear something, use it as a tool to change something. Now, we don't need to change everything all the time, but something inspirational, don't just be inspired, act inspired, and do something that's Yisrael. This is the last idea was by Matan Torah. Bnei Yisrael came to the Midbar, and we were Neged Hahar. Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Hahar. We camped opposite the mountain. So this scenario is a huge desert. The Jews are facing the mountain, and then came the Kabbalah Satayra. I heard a great idea that in order for us to be Makabal the Torah, we had to have our backs to the rest of the world. We're facing the mountain, and our backs were to the rest of the world. The idea is, we do not need to know what is going on. We do not need to be focused on the other parts of the world. We need to have our eye on the ball. We need to have our eye on the mountain. We have to have our eye on the Torah. And therefore, that was the makom of Kabbalah Satayra, completely desolate. And even in the desolation, we were focused on the mountain with our backs to the rest of the world. And that's something which today, especially, the world is crazy, immoral, terrible, so many horrible things going on in the world. If we are connected and so super duper connected to the world, then our eyes are not on the goal. Our eyes are not on Mantara. Our eyes are not facing the mountain. We have to, as much as we can, turn our backs to the world, to what else is going on. Again, what's relevant is relevant, but what's not super duper relevant to your life, just turn your back on it. You don't need to know it. You don't need to look into it. And therefore, that was the Kabbalah Zatarya we had in Har Sinai. And that is our personal Kabbalah Zatarya when we turn our back on the rest of the world. Have a very good Shabbos. I'll mention that next week. Hilchos Bathrooms. Good Shabbos.